Well, welcome everybody to Week, the Political Roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Monday, July 11th, 2016. So this week, former Texas Governor Rick Perry, he redefined Donald Trump's wall. Remember, Trump wants to build a wall and make the Mexican pay for it? Governor Perry said, it's not a real wall, it's going to be a technological wall, unquote, digital wall, unquote. And he says the Mexicans will still pay for it, so we'll see how that goes. Of course, everything technological is, doesn't banner ads pay for it? I mean, anyway, thanks for joining us here today in San Francisco. I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. Lots to talk about today. We'll, of course, discuss the shootings across the country, the presidential campaigns heading into their national conventions, a barrage of state propositions that are going to make this a very thick ballot in November here in California. Homelessness and some other political news. So, as always, I note that the Commonwealth Club has people of wide variety of views. They're all welcome here. Any views you hear expressed up here tonight are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. So, there are question cards spread throughout the room. I think most of you know how this is done. Write out your question, send them on up. We'll have people collect them and send them to me, and I'll try to ask as many as possible. So, let's meet our panelists for today. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage with Melissa Kane. She's a political analyst with CBS San Francisco and sfgate.com. She's on Twitter at MelissaKane1. Next to her is Dr. James Taylor, director of African American Studies and a professor of political science at the University of San Francisco. He's also a lecturer in the African American and African Diaspora Studies Department at University of California, Berkeley. And next to me is Carson Bruno, a research fellow at Hoover Institution. He's on Twitter at CarsonJFBruno. If we accomplish nothing else here, eventually we'll get Dr. Taylor onto Twitter. So let's move on.
I'm hiding.
Is James Taylor taken?
Stay in the load of radar.
Yeah, James Taylor's probably taken. Let's talk about the big issue, the issue that kind of has sobered up a lot of people in the country over the past week, and that is these shootings, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Minnesota, in Dallas last Thursday, was it, I believe? Let's start with Carson and just move right on down. I mean, what do you make of this week?
I've been downloading all this weekend trying to figure out what is going on in this country of ours, because it is very troubling, in my opinion, and I think in a lot of people's opinions. And when I kind of boil it down into kind of what's happening, it seems like we are being presented, all of us, a false dichotomy of choices. You are either, you know, pro-black and anti-cop, or anti-cop and pro-black, or vice versa. Yeah, you get where I'm going with that, right? Which I think is entirely false. I mean, you can be pro-cop and pro-black. It doesn't, being for one doesn't mean you're automatically against the other. And I feel like a lot of the cases, it's because there's really been no form of true leadership on this issue since we started seeing this happening a year ago or so. Our leaders are making it into a false choice. They're making it into an us versus them sort of choice. And I feel like that's a very sad state of our political system, of our leadership system, from the local level all the way up to the White House in D.C. And so it's a sad state of affairs that we find ourselves in, and one that increasingly is putting us into kind of ideological partisan corners, which is only making the situation worse and worse and worse. And it's a well-oiled tinderbox, I feel like, at this point. And it's only going to get worse unless both sides stand up and actually take true leadership and say, no, this is not a cops versus blacks issue. This is an American issue that we all need to be really dealing with right now.
For me, by the time the cop and the young person meets each other in a situation, there's so much else that has already happened and failed, the two of them. Structurally and socially, so that they are put in this position. I think Van Jones recently is trying to sort of find common ground between these two elements that you identify in terms of what they both are going through and the pressure, the scrutiny, the fears, the violence that they've become accustomed to. No two groups have more in common with each other than law enforcement and the besieged urban black community of young people. The violence, the daily threat of violence of that law enforcement wake up with.
Yeah.
Their whole commitment is to getting home. And as a young person of color in communities that are working class and poor, you have the same consciousness. I want to make it home. And so they have more in common with each other, but they can't see past, I think, that. And I think it's also a whole context and subtext of the structural questions. Our political institutions have lost support since the 1970s, going back to Nixon. Globally, I think people lost faith in institutions globally, but in America, it happened around Watergate, where political cynicism increased and political trust decreased. And you can see this with all three of our popular branches are have low ratings. The Congress, I think, was single digits for a long time. Now they're happy they got like about 15%, whoopee-doo. And then you have the presidency, independent of who's in it, is constantly lowly rated and lowly regarded. Since Ike Eisenhower, nobody's really liked anybody. As Mitt Romney said, 47% don't like whoever comes every 4 years. 47% of Americans are not going to like that person, I think, because of what you allude to in terms of the polarization that your colleague Morris Fiorina identifies down at Stanford with culture wars. The polarization, I said this last time I was here, polarization, I think, is the shibboleth under which so much of what we're experiencing is underwritten. In other words, if our political leadership class had any sort of working relationships, then they would be able to accomplish legislation to address the constant issues that we're facing. But because the red America and the blue America, and it's not racial, it's ideological, don't talk to each other, the political class and the law enforcement classes don't have to listen to anybody.
Okay.
Because nobody's in charge.
Yeah. Let's let Melissa in here.
In addition to the racial issues, which are obviously very clear here, there's a gun control issue that's coming up. I mean, we forget that in the 60s and 70s, thank you. A number of gun control measures were protested by the black community because they thought that they were racially motivated, that you were sort of penalizing possession of guns in an effort to find new and inventive ways to penalize the black community. And that's sort of gone away, and then the gun rights issue became one of more of a conservative, for the conservative folks, for white folks. But now what I'm really interested to see is if the shooting of children in Connecticut isn't going to get us there, then something needs to change. And maybe this is part of what that is, where we start saying, you know what, even conservatives can get behind people taking aim at police. And so maybe we're seeing a little bit of the muddying, maybe a little bridge, so folks can start to consider and envision a world where we actually have some more controls over who has bomb-making equipment and guns and things like that. So that's the other thing that I'm looking, in addition to the racial stuff, which you guys have both addressed very well, that's the other thing that I hope people are thinking about as a result.
The police chief, David Brown, earlier today, he said police officers are being put in a position where they need to deal with, quote, societal failures, unquote, for which they're not equipped, right? So they're dealing with mental health issues, they're dealing with drug addiction and such, that they're being put in these places. It's kind of like when we take our military and they say, oh, you're actually nation building.
Yeah.
And they're like, I was trained to point a gun. He said, quote, policing was never meant to solve these problems. I ask other parts of our democracy, as well as the free press, to help us not put that burden all on law enforcement to resolve, unquote. You've talked about, the lack of leadership and the lack of trust in the leadership institutions. If there's going to be any inspiration to change this, on both sides, because we've now seen it kind of really blow up in our faces, where would it come from? I mean, and what could be done? And I know that's a very broad question.
Please send us a Lincoln. But here's the thing. I mean, I love your metaphor because that's so true. I mean, you can't say, here, go be a therapist. Here, go be a social worker. And we ask our teachers, I think, to fill in a lot of these gaps. And look, the simple fact is we've, since the 80s, been decimating the funding for other public institutions that might be helpful in this regard. And I think when we talk about the issue of homelessness, which we've just had like a massive sort of media blitz on homelessness in the Bay Area. One of the things you have to talk about is, this happens and we start raising our expectations of other public actors when we lose sort of the structural framework. And it seems like, I seem to remember the early 90s, we passed a ballot measure for a small little tax that was supposed to fund mental health in the state of California. And that has just been in the wind. No one knows where it is. It's all like you have to give it. It's very Soviet bureaucratic. You got this committee that delegates it to this committee. It's a mess. It has not actually made much of any effect at all in the state of California. So what I think, so obviously what we need are, other institutions, other ways of helping to deal with this that are accountable, that are not crazy bureaucracies, so that we can get people the help they need.
And I think one source of leadership that you're talking about might be at the local level. I don't see it at the national level of politics. And perhaps, at the local level, you yourself might be able to identify some people who you admire here locally. And that's consistent with what happens in polling around congressional leadership in general. For example, people think Congress is horrible, but they think Nancy Pelosi or Barbara Lee is the best thing since sliced bread. And perhaps that's, part of what our assessment is. And I have faith in a democracy. People have given up on the pushback of the democracy in terms of law enforcement, in terms of these issues. I have faith in the wisdom of democracy in the long run to win out, as it always has so far.
And I think
even after this primary season?
I tell you what, if Donald Trump loses, then I will recant. But if he wins, I will own it. But if he wins, I'll recant. I'm so scared I can't even say it right. That makes me nervous. No, but if he wins, I'll recant. But if he loses, I stand on democracy with a small D.
I think a lot of, there's a saying, in politics that all politics is local. And I think a lot of people, a lot of voters have kind of forgotten that. Just because you elect your congresswoman or man to D.C., or you elect, your senator to D.C., or you elect your state senator to Sacramento or whatnot, doesn't mean that they are completely abdicated from what is happening here locally. Mm-hmm. We're seeing on the housing issue. We're seeing on many different issues. The mental health is an excellent example where the impact of mental health funding is really at the local level, but it's dictated by Sacramento or by what's happening in D.C. It's not really being dictated by what's happening in City Hall here or in San Jose or wherever you might be. So I feel like a lot of times voters need to start to realize and put even more pressure on their congressmen, on their state senators, on their state assemblymen, as well as their city council members, to really try to say, you have to stand up and you have to start to figure out what to do. It may not require state action, but if there is a state senator or a state assembly member putting pressure on our city council members, stuff may start to actually occur.
And don't we see in a lot of elections, especially presidential elections, from the top of the ballot down, you have a drop-off of people who actually are filling out the thing.
Yeah.
They're not voting. They're getting out there because they want to vote for or against Mitt Romney or whomever. It goes further down. They come across a bunch of names they'd never paid attention to, or it's just city council, who cares, right? But of course, it's the city council that will affect, what taxes they're paying, whether there's a police officer, whether it's a good police, all that kind of stuff.
I wonder how much of that also is, again, just the general populace not demanding more of their local media.
Yeah.
Because it's, as someone who studies this sort of stuff, it's really hard to find information about these people who are running for your local city council, and let alone then the water districts and the fire districts and all that sort of stuff.
Let me defend local media here for just a moment.
I'm sorry, I was not like...
I felt it. I know. But here's the thing. If local media does something, let's say we do a 5-part series on your local congresspeople. And so KPIX, for example, is Bay Area, right? It's not just San Francisco. We've got, all the nine counties. We would run it, and the ratings would be absolute garbage. Like, no one will watch it. Everyone always says, oh, media, why do you pay so much attention to Donald Trump? Because people watch it. Like, the media, you know, responds to what people will pay attention to. You can't feed them oatmeal and expect them to come back. They're in the business. We are in the business of you know, selling advertising based on views. And maybe that's a terrible system that should be changed. But yes, it is what it is. And while it is, you know, you can't expect it to be PBS.
And I totally agree with that. That's why I feel like it needs to come from people like you guys who come to events like this to really try to force your neighbors and your friends to say, start paying attention to this sort of stuff. Start demanding it more from...
Start eating your oatmeal.
Yes.
Well, you guys gave us a question that is going to make lots of people mad. Isn't the problem with police and state violence, doesn't it have more to do with police unions and for-profit policing?
I guess someone read the San Francisco police report, the autopsy that came out today.
And we'll get into that a little later, yeah.
Please restate the question.
Doesn't the problem with police and state violence have more to do with police unions and for-profit policing?
I don't know much about for-profit policing, but the police unions, you know, whether we're talking about the Corrections Corporations of America, the California Corrections Officers and Peace Officers Union is the most powerful union in the state of California, or one of the two top, you know, unions in the state. They're powerful. We saw Patrick Kelly turn the NYPD against the mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, last December when they turned their back on him publicly more than once, if you remember. That's power. And Pat Kelly is speaking out into this environment. And there's no humility. There's no let's make reconciliation. There's no blue and black reconciliation. Let's find common ground. There's none of that in New York. It's doubling down and saying Eric Garner was resisting and deserved the choke out that he got and things of that sort. So people are heartbroken in Dallas. And what's really profound, and again, you may not appreciate this, but as soon as Dylan Roof shot and the mass killing in Charleston, South Carolina, before the first half hour of the shooting, a note came out to the national media to say, we forgive him. The parents weren't even dead. The blood was still warm. And the family sent out the message to America, we forgive this boy. I know what that's grounded in. That's grounded in the Black Protestant tradition that Martin Luther King and a whole lot of other people we both know represent, even Amos Brown here in San Francisco. You know, that's very powerful. And yet, I can't imagine it would be accepted in this country if one of the families came out right now and said to Micah Xavier Johnson, we forgive you, in Christian Dallas, Texas, where the Bible Belt and the Bible is strong. Black folk forgave in Charleston. Nobody's forgiven this boy in Dallas. And he's their creature, their creation. He was trained by them, equipped and educated by them. He used state-sanctioned, state-trained violence against state-sanctioned, state-trained violence. And if you really pull away from what happened, independent of the citizens and cops, black and blue, you had soldiers against soldiers. That was a fair fight, except that he, you know, except by the element of surprise. And they responded in kind in a military way, not in some civilian law enforcement way. They blew him up with a 1 pound C4 bomb. Are you okay with that? As Americans, that the American government, again, they said two black people that two nights ago were guilty of this crime. One, we know they said was guilty, Mr. Houston, turned out to be innocent. And then they kept his picture on the Dallas web PD webpage all day yesterday, and they refused to say this man is innocent. He's in hiding now because Dallas PD just now came around to saying he's innocent.
One of the things that struck me as perhaps ironic, it sounds like I'm trying to make a joke out of it, and I'm not. But one of the ironic things of this happening in Dallas is that wasn't Dallas doing a lot of, the police department, doing a lot of the things that people have been asking for police to do?
Because of Chief Brown.
Right.
I mean, he's exceptional. I mean, he's outstanding. I don't agree with his decision, I violently disagree with that decision, but I listened to him on the way here. And he's from the neighborhood. He's from the community. He's from the bottom. Just like here in Oakland, we have Daniel Outlaw, who is a deputy police officer in the Oakland Police Department. With all the scandal they have going there, they have a black woman who's more than qualified to run the Department of Oakland PD. But for some reason, Libby Schaft and others won't tap her office.
She'll get to her pretty soon.
I hope so, because Daniel Outlaw, much like Chief Brown, comes from Oakland, from the community, from the bottom. She worked her way up through the scout program, what they have for young people, and then becomes a deputy chief of police, and almost became a chief of police, I think, of Fayetteville, North Carolina, if I'm not mistaken. She was the number two candidate. And yet we have all this scandal in Oakland, no looking at her. And yet with Chief Brown, again, the gift that he presents is there's a sense of authenticity he brings to the table because he comes from the community. And they know, even though he has to enforce the law, that he has their best interest at heart. And what most people don't understand is there's a current in black community, even in the worst ones, of conservatism, where people renounce this stuff. If you're stuck in those communities, you can't get out, but you surely are not welcoming those conditions. You're not welcoming drive-by shootings. You're not welcoming 9mm. You're not welcoming everyday policing, where in Ferguson, every family in the black community in Ferguson had 3 warrants. How many warrants do you have in your family?
Well, and you also, I hope, probably saw that story. The man who was killed in Minnesota had been stopped.
Yeah, Phil Castile.
Phil Castile, thank you. He had previously been stopped like something like 50 times.
$6,000 in tickets.
Yeah. And he did not make San Francisco salary.
And see, what's really frightening about this is the more, according to a Stanford University study by 2 women psychologists recently, just last year, the more whites, listen to this, and you have to look this up for yourself, the more whites from San Francisco and New York are told about these things, the more they support the policies that create them. That's a study done at Stanford University last year by 2 women psychologists, that the more liberal whites in San Francisco and New York are exposed to the inequalities, the inequities, the more they support them. Okay. It's this sort of not in my backyard phenomena.
I've got a question from the audience that sort of takes off.
I didn't come here. I came sincerely, but I didn't come to offend.
An audience member asks, this issue was accentuated during the Clinton administration. The general decline of democracy and integrity in government began with Bill and Hillary Clinton. Will America continue on the self-serving leaderless pack?
Carson, sure Clinton.
He did his best to pick it up.
It might have become with like Martin Van Buren. Like, I think it was like way back before that. But I do want to, to the previous question though, I do want to just add in, this is one of the interesting fault lines among progressives, right? And we're talking about this in the green room a bit, where, you know, very, very pro-union, except police, except maybe the building trades, because they're super, in favor of development. But we're really good with the service employee unions because they agree with us. And so, you know, we're going to say we love all unions just because, like, we actually really love this one particular subset of public employees. But when you think about, again, fault lines, conservatives who may be rethinking gun control, maybe some liberals rethinking public employee unions based on this, and maybe not wholesale, but at least for some sectors, pointing to that. And so I have plenty of friends who are Democrats who say, yes, public, unions are good for private sectors, but they're just not, appropriate in the public sector because you have, sort of a bottomless purse and unaccountable leaders. So sort of on the Republican side, you sort of got one thing that they need to look at. Maybe on the sort of liberal or progressive side, there's an additional sort of overarching philosophy to really think about.
Okay, well, let's move on to the presidential campaign. You might have heard about this. It's going on. We're selecting a president.
We've talked about this since like 20 years.
Yes. And in particular, of course, a week from today, the Republican National Convention begins. I believe it's the following Monday, the Democratic National Convention begins. So, line up your popcorn and wine or whatever, because it's going to be fun. But let's actually start with kind of the lead-in. Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders is expected to endorse Hillary Clinton, either finally or, oh darn it, depending on where your views are on that. But I thought it was interesting, I think either last week or the week before, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump made trips to Congress. So Bernie Sanders met with House Democrats. Donald Trump met separately with House Republicans and Senate Democrats, excuse me, Senate Republicans. They were rather interesting. I don't know if you got that news in Croatia, but what do you make of that? I mean, that is, for example, does Bernie Sanders have a message there as a candidate yet, or is he now, for example, is he now a surrogate for Clinton?
Well, I've been saying this for a really long time. I think really since Bernie Sanders got into the race, I think his success was really a surprise to him, to be honest. But he got into the race for the issues, he cares about a lot. There are a few. I guess they're deviations of one another. But he cares about what he stands for, what he's always stood for. He hasn't really gotten much done in his time in D.C., but he stands for what he stands for. And I think he was really trying. He knew that the Clintons are a wily bunch, that they... I'm looking at you, Melissa. But they triangulate. That's what they do, and they do it very well. And they've been very successful at it in their entire careers. So he wanted to make sure that Hillary Clinton stayed the course with what he cared about, and it's been the entire kind of theme of his entire presidential campaign thus far. And as long as he is still a candidate, as long as he has not fully endorsed her, he still carries a lot of weight. He still carries a lot of panache. He still can demand things from D.C.
Tomorrow he becomes irrelevant.
I think so. I'm actually quite surprised they're doing it as soon as they are.
Really?
Yes. I thought he was going to hold out until at least the convention was near over, so that he could make sure that there was no kind of last minute decisions made by the platform committee, made by the rules committee, made by XYZ committee at the convention, to really ensure that Clinton was locked down in what he wanted her to be locked down in. And I really think that his meeting with the House Democrats really was to kind of say, look, I expect these things from you, and you better give them to me. Largely, he's been very successful in this endeavor. He's really changed the tone on the Democratic side. He's really changed the issues that they've been talking about, and he's really forced Clinton to say things that I guarantee she did not want to have to say during this whole course, because if it were anyone else but Trump, she would be in a lot of trouble because of some of the things that she has positioned herself on when it comes to just appealing to the masses, to the middle of America.
Well, let's face it, Sanders was waiting to see if she was going to get arrested. He was like, go to jail, maybe. Okay, not. Okay, fine. I guess I'll
Trump said he lost
endorse
the indictment caucus. the indictment primary, he lost.
Exactly.
What did you think of you bring it up, the FBI, it's not an exoneration, but it's a... Someone in the audience says whitewash.
Whitewash.
But he has said, and there are a number of legal experts, you're a legal expert. Was there a case there?
He was politically indicted, but Donald Trump wasted 2 days playing around about his hair and all this other stuff when he should have been pouncing on the moment when it was most raw.
Yeah.
He blew it. He had an opportunity, and I think he blew it, Trump.
Well, tell me who is a Republican, at least, I guess. Well, until recently, I guess he renounced his party affiliation, but... Many people have. which again helps. You know, I think people understand that it was, he was trying to be more impartial, and he sort of gave it some red meat to the conservatives, and then sort of let her off the hook for the Democrats. He said that the reason, like the two factors they looked at, was the amount of evidence, the amount of sort of classified material that was improperly used was small, right? It's like less than a dozen emails. Give or take. Nuclear codes, who cares? It's a tiny... I'm not defending her. But he said, and also the intent, for whatever reason, she and her team had convinced him, I guess, sufficiently that they didn't mean to do any of this. And again, in my non-defense of the Clintons, understand this, the kind of hubris it takes to be like, Secretary of State at Yahoo.com. What could go wrong? I'll just have my home. That's cool. Oh, Loretta Lynch is next door? I'm going to go have a chat with her, here at the airport. Right. What are you thinking? Yeah. And I feel like there's a lot of people, even Democrats, who want to like Hillary Clinton and want to support her more. But they just... don't let you because they keep doing things like this. No. So you're like, why did you do that? How did you think you could get away with that? It drives you crazy.
So you have Barbara Lee coming out this week, I think today too, endorsing her, and Elizabeth Warren last week, and now Bernie Sanders is sort of shoring up the old DNC, the old New Deal Great Society wing of the party. And I think people forget that Jesse Jackson, for better and for worse, ran to challenge not simply Reagan, but the centrist drift of the Democrats as he understood Clinton's intentions. So Jesse was running against this move to the right. And I think Bernie understood that this was a war for the soul of the party to the extent that Hillary represents its centrist orientation and not its liberal or progressive orientation, except on women's issues and children's issues. She's liberal there, but she's conservative and even neoconservative on a lot of other issues. And so...
This was a fact I think was kind of brushed over because of what was happening on the Republican side, that you did see a very dramatic shift in the Democratic primary electorate from 2008. Mm-hmm. You saw a shift toward strong majorities toward liberal to voters saying that they were self-classified themselves as liberals, mm-hmm. Which you saw in the Republican side, 2004-esque around that election. But you saw a massive shift from 2008 to 2016. So it's very apparent that amongst the Democratic rank and file voters that this was an issue that they really wanted to be having discussed at the presidential level. But the candidates themselves weren't really the people that the options weren't presented to them. So it's not surprising that Sanders did as well as he did in retrospect. When he first announced, it was kind of like, why?
But I don't think anybody is happily endorsing her on the left. I don't think Elizabeth Warren was excited about it, even though she has to go public and say she was. Barbara Lee is not excited about it.
Quotes is probably a stretch.
Right.
I'm sure there are plenty of enthusiastic, especially of the there's a generation and an affiliation of folks for whom she is, they understand her and like her.
For sure.
Yeah. So, and that's kind of been that's kind of been a Sanders complaint of like, oh, well, you can settle for Hillary or go with your heart for him. Right. I think it's kind of insulting to the folks who actually agree with her on the issues and say, Melissa, it's like, we wish you wouldn't keep doing this kind of thing.
Right.
But actually, we're excited about
I
that.
I agree.
So Donald Trump also went to Congress, had one of my favorite meetings with the Senate Democrats. And someone once described the senator, 100 senators.
Republicans.
Did I say Democrats? That would have been a good one, actually. He met with Senate Republicans, and someone once was describing, the Senate is basically made up of 100 people, all of whom think they can be president, right? They're not cowed by the president, and they're certainly not cowed by someone a lot of them are worried could cost them the majority in the Senate and possibly even their own seats. Well, he gets into an argument with Senator Flake from Arizona. And he starts off basically by saying, well, you've been critical of me. And Flake says, yeah. brings up again some of these criticisms of what Trump has said, including his insult. I think Flake said, yes, I'm the senator from Arizona who was not captured. And that's one of the things I want to talk to you about. In other words, to go after Trump on some of his more outrageous insults. And Trump then basically said, well, I haven't gone after you much, but I could. And so this continued on. And Trump basically then said, well, you're a loser. You're going to lose your reelection bid.
Yeah.
And Flake said, I'm not up for reelection.
Then he went to other senators and started arguing with them as well. Yeah.
So, it was a win. It was winning.
Sad.
Yes.
He did well with House Republicans,
though. That is true.
They say the ones that liked him going in liked him coming out, but the senators were not feeling him at all.
Small bun, so, I mean.
So what can we expect at this convention, for the Republican convention first? Is there still a dump Trump movement that has any power? Are we likely to see any of that, do you think? And you were shaking, nodding your head. Melissa?
Yes, first of all, I'm going. I'm so excited. I started packing in December. I'm very excited. I have a gas mask and all sorts of things. it's going to be dicey, especially with a media pass. Like, no likey. So here's the thing. The Rules Committee is meeting this week, and the Rules Committee, again, sort of comes up with the rules, as you might imagine. And they... In order to get something in front of the whole delegation, and for sort of all the delegates, like 2,500 delegates, the full arena full of folks, you have to go through the Rules Committee. So what is underfoot right now is this Rules Committee, which is made up of about 112 people. You need 28 of them to get to something called the Minority Report. And so there's a group afoot, like the Dump Trump folks are trying to get this Minority Report through the Rules Committee. They just need those 28 votes. And if they get them, something will go to the full sort of floor of 2,500 delegates. And the thing they're trying to get through is something called the Conscience Clause. And the Conscience Clause basically says, like, forget who you're bound to, vote your conscience, and not Donald Trump. they don't really contemplate anyone like voting for Donald Trump out of their conscience. So they're trying to get this through the committee, and yesterday, they said they had the 28 votes. Now, this is going to be public. This is actually going to be on C-SPAN, too. And because they're at the Commonwealth Club, I know y'all have it. So this Thursday and Friday, watch, because it's going to be public. It's going to be on TV. The committee is going to vote on whether to have this conscience clause be submitted to the full complement of delegates. And again, they only need 28 votes. And again, now they think that they have them. If that were to happen, if they were to get through the committee and the whole sort of, you know, all the delegates got to vote, it could pass. A recent study by a Trump supporter actually showed that about 900 of the delegates are on the fence, right? The rest are sort of evenly split between sort of never and definitely. And there's 900 in the middle. That's a big, mushy middle. So it is definitely possible. I mean, think about it. You're going to an arena full of people being like, everybody who wants to do whatever you want, say aye. You know, like, it's not the hardest sell, right? So if it were to get through the Rules Committee, again, as a minority report, it could pass on the floor, and in which case, holy moly, it was nice knowing you. thank you for all the time here at Commonwealth Club. But it would be a total mess. So there is a possibility. Now, and again, but it really relies on that group in the Rules Committee to come up with the 28 votes if they can't. And everyone on the Rules Committee is just getting bombarded right now. I have a friend who's on it, and like, I'm hearing all sorts of things about harassment. Not harassment. She didn't say harassment, but I say harassment. Lobbying. Aggressive lobbying. Again, because everyone, again, because the membership is public, again, the meeting is going to be public, the vote is going to be public. So, you know, anyone, you know, who's interested in, like, making sure their house is safe, their kids are safe, things like that are really, you know, having to think about those kind of things at this moment. So, anyway, to answer your question, yes, there is a possibility.
And a big development that occurred this afternoon was a Virginia judge ruled that a Virginia state law, Commonwealth law, that says that delegates to both parties, just not just Republicans, but both parties, there's a law in Virginia that says that delegates to that state, for that state, to the national convention, must vote for the bounded person that they're allotted to vote for. Otherwise, it's something like 12 months in jail and $6,000 fine. It's pretty extreme, actually.
What are you in for?
Right? Election law can be, there's just some absurd things in election law when you really start to drill down to it. But a Never Trump delegate sued the state, and a judge said, no, the state of Virginia, Commonwealth of Virginia, cannot.
Did they rule on constitutional grounds or state law grounds?
I'm not sure about.
Okay.
So, but there are other states that have these rules that say, no, you have to do this, otherwise you can be thrown in jail or fined. Right. Now, what prosecutor is really going to go do that? But still,
now,
it's enough to scare.
Has a law saying you shall vote, you know, for the, you know, whoever wins. But it's not clear what the enforcement
right.
is.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you go, okay, well, I did it anyway. Sue me. Arrest me when I land in at SFO.
Yeah.
But the damage would have been done by that
but
point.
But because we now see that, you know, the judges are willing to, like, yeah, no, that's not really it can't be a law. It might embolden the never Trumpers, the dump Trumps, once they get to Cleveland, to be able to do so. The problem is, though, then what?
Mm. Right.
They're not agreeing on kind of a savior white horse candidate. They're
John Kasich, who won his home state.
Right, but there's also Cruz.
And only his home state, I might point out.
But there's also Senator Cruz. There's also Mitt Romney. There's also Speaker Ryan. I mean, there's a lot of coalitions within the Dump Trump, the Never Trump group that really are at odds with one another.
Yes, there are a lot of other people
yeah.
who will never be president.
But exactly.
I would imagine that movement gets new energy at the convention if Donald Trump announces it. Is it General Kelly that he's considering?
Oh, yeah. Michael Flynn?
Flynn.
I'm sorry,
Flynn.
I apologize.
Yeah,
Flynn.
Yeah.
Flynn.
Explain who he is.
He's apparently, I don't know a lot about him, apparently he's a pro-choice Democrat. That's going to be one of the two or three people being vetted by Donald Trump. So I can't imagine conservatives are okay with this.
Well, you know, Trump does so well with the evangelicals on his own. He doesn't need. No, I'm kidding. No, he totally needs. But now they're saying Mike Pence, the Indiana yeah. governor, yeah. Mike Pence.
Which is not good. Didn't he have some scandal last year in his state where they tried to come up with an anti-LGBT law that just the backlash was just so fierce, he rescinded it? Remember that?
Yeah, fix this now.
Yeah.
That was the headline.
Yeah. And he responded. So that's just probably not good for them, you know, coming from red Indiana.
Yeah. He seems to be the front runner now. Having said that, though, really anybody but Trump would do. Because here's the thing. It's not I don't think it's necessarily this point about winning the presidency as it is keeping the Senate, right? They're just like, can we just like White House? Okay, fine, done. But we can't, but there's potential. Even Ruth Bader Ginsburg the other day said there's up to three justices that the next president is going to have to appoint. And she's one of them. You know, like, she didn't say that, but
yes.
So I mean, you got to keep the houses, right? You got to keep the Senate and you got to keep the House of Representatives, which even that with the Democrats in need of more than 30 seats is now kind of, you know, in question with Trump at the top of the ticket. They're like, just put anybody, just literally like Donald Duck, like whatever, just like somebody at the top of the ticket that everyone doesn't hate. So we can like preserve the Senate and the House at least. So if you start thinking about the sort of the options as not so much let's find somebody who could win the presidency as let's find someone who won't lose everything, then the list gets a little longer.
How about Ivanka? They were shopping Ivanka the last 2 days.
Yeah.
My sister's cute, so she'd be a good VP.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah, the daughter who he said he might date if she weren't the daughter. Yeah.
Lord, the evangelicals have a lot to answer for. That's deep.
So, someone in the audience asks, to what extent do you think Donald Trump will try to retaliate against officials and politicians and the media as well who try to prevent him from becoming the nominee for the Republican Party? He has a history with threatening media persons.
He likes to say he's going to sue, right? In the USA Today
yeah.
study.
He does. I mean, he likes to say a lot of things. And he gets on Twitter. He, you know, gets in Twitter wars with Rosie O'Donnell or, you know, name the person. But he doesn't ever really do anything afterward. Probably because he's not worth the amount of money that he actually says he's worth. Again, why would anyone be afraid of him when it comes to that sort of stuff? Because he's has a repeated pattern of threatening things and then backing off. He's a classic bully in that sense.
He has a long memory. If you listen to him engage individuals, he tells them about his relationship to them. I remember you when, or you're okay. You know, he already has it made in his mind how he would receive you based on what little information he got on you before he came to the Commonwealth Club, if he ever would come. He just seems to have that. And that's the one thing I guess I would say I admire about Donald Trump is he knows who his enemies are. And he's identified who his major critics are. And he keeps this is bad in the Nixon sense, but he keeps a list of you know, of people who've been very critical of him. And he tells them at a certain point, you were really, you know, rude to me.
But that's all he does, though. He just tells them or tweets it out or does something in that regard that you don't like me. I don't like you. Okay.
I wish I could get into a fight with Donald Trump. My Twitter followers would go through the roof.
Someone asks, I'm worried about guns at the Republican convention in Cleveland. You're going? You're going to wear a flak jacket?
I should, if anyone has one. Size, whatever, we'll tell you later. Who's going? Is somebody going?
Anyone going?
There was a move to, like, the Republicans actually had to consider whether to allow people to bring guns into the arena. They decided against it. Few. But still, then there's the outside of the arena, which is actually where everything's going to be taking place in terms of protesters and conflict and things like that. So there are a number of Republican delegates who have said they're going to bring their guns with them and carry them to restaurants and other events outside of the convention space. So, fun. Plus the $50 million that the federal government gave to Cleveland for sort of anti-terror, prevention. There's going to be a lot going on there. I have to say, again, as a member of the media, I am nervous. Because you just don't know. There's going to be groups. There's the anti-Trump group. There's the anti-Trump group of conservatives, then there's the pro-Trump people, then there's the police, and then there's the National Guard,
and Black Lives Matter, who's in Cleveland.
I consider that as part of the anti-Trump. Yeah. But so there's going to be just sort of, you feel like you're sort of in Five Points in New York, and the gangs of New York, and you're just like over here, like, I just want to take a picture with my iPhone, it's definitely going to be a bit scary, but my husband's going to be there with me, and I assume he will at least yell mean things at people who are mean to me.
since the last 2 years, they've been in constant protest in Cleveland. Even tonight, there's a protest in Cleveland around the Black Lives Matter movement, and so Cleveland PD has been at the center of it with Tamir Rice, and I think in the suburbs of Cleveland where the young man was shot at Walmart, John Crawford. So Cleveland PD has been they shot up two black people driving a car unarmed 137 times. They've been the focus of police protests. So I think they're prepared based on the fact that this is nothing new for them except the pitch and the level of intensity with all the media, I think. But you can't underestimate the value to law enforcement to have the practice for the past 2 years of preparing for this kind of stuff.
If heaven forbid Trump were elected president, those of you on the radio, I'm reading this. This is not my own. If heaven forbid Donald Trump were elected president, what are the chances he would blow off the presidency? We've kind of touched on this in previous programs. Does he really actually even want to be president?
My husband has been saying from day one that this is kind of like Bernie Sanders, like you said, he did not think that this was going to get so real. And that at some point he'd be like, you know what, this is actually really horrible and I don't like this. And you know what, my brand is what it is. I've increased my net worth. I've increased my real net worth. I've increased my imaginary net worth. I've increased all of it. Now I'm worth $1 trillion. So you know what? This is kind of a headache, and I kind of don't want to get involved. And at the very least, it makes his VP pick pretty important, since that person may have a very real shot of being the first person to become president because of a resignation.
I think Americans have to brace themselves now for the reality that Donald Trump is one of the two people who might become president. I think we have to mentally process that now and not react in November to it as a possibility.
Well, and right along those lines.
And I think we need to understand the same way in London. We did that for real? And now there's this, they want to have three million people want to re-vote. No, you can't re-vote for the presidency. Once Trump is in, he's in. Yeah. And we are stuck with it for 4 years unless he's impeached.
And when you have two candidates that are both as disliked as they both are. I mean, it's not like Hillary Clinton's like a Barack Obama, who even when he was running for re-election, he wasn't beloved like he was in 2008, but he still had a fairly decent favorable rating, a fairly decent approval rating. Hillary Clinton is not like that. She is just as unliked as Donald Trump is in some polls, maybe marginally better in others. So it's a sort of thing where, Clinton is the favorite at this point. There's no doubt about that. But crazy things can happen.
I would no longer be surprised if Donald Trump becomes president. I was maybe 4 or 5 months ago, but now I would not be surprised if Donald Trump became president. And I'll tell you why. This is more about California politics. In 1992, you had the Los Angeles uprisings and riots, remember? In 1994, you had the OJ stuff that they're showing now. But in 1996, the California electorate, I argue, rioted back. They didn't riot out in the streets with the community when it rioted in reaction to the police. They rioted at the polls. And I'm afraid that with the current situation, with the violence we see in the streets, with Donald Trump saying, I'm Richard Nixon and I'm representing the silent moral majority of white America, that we have to put these people back in line. We need order in America. That's what Nixon says. And now Trump is coming out and saying this. And it seems to me that, you know, we're at a situation where Donald Trump could be elected as a part of that backlash, that resentment. That, again, 1992, white people saw what happened. They expressed 70% opposition to the verdict of O.J. Simpson. They were really angry. I was in Southern California. They were angry statewide. And then here we are, 92, but 96 came around. The electorate said affirmative action, gone. And it's gone. And it has not come back. That is what I'm afraid of, is that the silent majority of whites who are irritated by these things will be inspired by Trump to go ahead and vote for Trump, to punish, to riot back in response to Ferguson, Baltimore, everything we've been seeing this week. I'm convinced that white people will go into those polls and vote for Donald Trump under these circumstances. Does anybody disagree with me?
Oh.
Some do.
Well, okay. I think
our one saving grace is the Electoral College, luckily. Yes. And that's why I think the people who want to get rid of the Electoral College, no, this is designed to prevent massive emotion majority, or what you might want to call it, against making rash decisions like this. The one saving grace in this regard is the Electoral College. Okay. It makes that situation a lot more difficult.
Donald Trump for Americans to finally say, you know, the Electoral College makes sense. Next, he'll like somehow make us like daylight savings time next.
I was saying, just thank God for the wisdom of the framers, you know, the wisdom.
Yeah, you got to believe that some Republicans are like, man, I wish we had some superdelegates.
Okay. Them.
Before we move on just a little bit more, someone actually asked, why are we still talking about Trump? Well, so what do you think about the whole hullabaloo about Donald Trump and the Star of David? Now, did you all see this? It was all over the place. He retweeted out an image showing Hillary Clinton with a background of lots of money cascading behind her and a Star of David with the words, I think, most corrupt politician or something like that. Turns out that exact image, or most of it, had appeared first on a white supremacist website. And so he then was trying to, you know, oh, well, no, it's not a Star of David. It's like a sheriff's badge, which I loved because someone then tweeted a photo of a cemetery showing all the Star of Davids on the graves and just said, oh, look, a cemetery full of sheriffs.
Then he said it was like one of the an image on a on the coloring book for the yes. cartoon Frozen. He said, oh, so Frozen is anti-Semitic because there was a star that was similar on the cover of a coloring book.
Teflon candidate, or did that
I don't
stick?
Know if it's Teflon or if it's just like the bar is so low. It's like, well, okay. Like, was anyone shocked by that? Was anyone like, wait, what? Wait a minute. Is he doing that? Is he unbelievable? I did not know that. Like, I don't think that was really news to anybody. I think the reason it was even newsworthy was because he is supposed to be now surrounded by
adults.
Folks who are supposed to be getting him ready for the big show, you know, like just, you know, you got to get your eye crusties out and, you know, get your good suit on and get ready for the thing. And that was the idea, is that he's got, you know, the crew, he's ready for his montage, right? You know, dun, dun, dun. And in the middle of it, you're like, uh-oh, this transition to being more presidential is not necessarily happening. I think that's why it was newsworthy, not necessarily because it was from him.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, it really goes to show that the Senate Republicans, the House Republicans, or, you know, the establishment, whoever they might be, are really kind of sticking their head in the sand when it comes to, like, oh, don't worry, he'll change. And no, there's been no evidence in his entire career, actually, as a public person, that he will ever change. So they're just really kind of just, oh, this is what we got. So let's just hope, you know, amazing. One day he wakes up and it's like, oh, yeah.
The problem is that the people who are most inclined to vote are going to lock in on this election in August, September, October, November. The behavior of Trump up to this point, you know, of course, even serious voters are aware of it. But, you know, traditionally in American politics, people sort of lock in the independents, the non-aligned individual, you know, decline the state type individuals. They come around late in the game. And they also are much more, I think, discerning in terms of their policy questions. They might be issue oriented specifically as opposed to party oriented. And I think this bodes, you know, negatively for Trump in the long run, because the more serious people who are the most reliable voters in America are are not inclined to accept this behavior. It's completely unacceptable except for entertainment value. And again, one commentator on CNN put this out, and she said, there's nothing that Donald Trump has, in other words, I remember when Jesse Jackson ran, and everybody in the media said, why is Jesse running? Why is Jesse running? And then Al Sharpton ran, and I consider Al Sharpton to be a clown and a buffoon, I do. And why is Al Sharpton running? But when you sort of think about Donald Trump's behavior, Donald Trump's behavior is completely unacceptable in anyone other than a white person. What black candidate would we allow to act like that? What Latino candidate, what woman candidate would we allow to act like Donald Trump? And so people can sigh and say, whoa, no. The proof is Donald Trump is the Republican nominee. And he has behaved in ways that if Jesse Jackson said one thing, he said Hymetown back when he described New York as Hymetown, which is a racial slur offending Jews. And it was like, Jesse, you are immoral and irredeemable. And Jesse's campaign was over as soon as it started. For that one phrase, Farrakhan emerges and attacks the Washington Post reporter Coleman, who exposed Jesse for that. But Jesse, his campaign was still born, even though he won 10 million votes across the primary. Jesse, you can't, even as an African-American, what you just did was irredeemable. And Donald Trump has done this to the 1500 power and offended every group he could think of. Now, he had been safe with gays and safe with Jews. And now, actually not true, not really, because he did some things with Bernie, if you remember, on Twitter that showed Bernie in the oven, if you remember. But he was really careful not to offend gays, but he's gone and offended just about everybody else, and gays are having issues with him as well.
Well, let's briefly, before we get to the news quiz, I wanted to talk about some of the propositions that are going to be on the November ballot. There are about 4,000 of them. We're going to go through them one by one tonight. By last count, I saw there were 18. Are we past the deadline, or will any more be added?
The legislature can put some more on. I don't know if any more are in the qualification stage when it comes to signatures, okay, though.
I think some others are still having their signatures looked at that could be on. And the thing is, we're in, for those of you who are in San Francisco, we are in this horrible, horrible death spiral vortex. Because the reason why there's so many on the November ballot is because you tie the number of signatures you need to the most recent gubernatorial election, which was Jerry Brown's reelection, which like nobody showed up for because whatever, it's Jerry Brown. So the signature threshold is super low right now. And of course it's a presidential year as well. So you sort of have like a million things getting on that ballot. San Francisco, same way. We tie ours to the election of the mayor, who ran for reelection against like nobody and won at Buffer like with like 12 votes. So like the number of votes you need to get on the ballot is super low. So we're going to end up with like a local ballot that's like this and a state ballot that's like this. Like it's going to be absolutely horrendous for local folks. And seriously, you know, it's something that people hold dear. The initiative process is something people hold dear. If you poll people on it, they will overwhelmingly say, absolutely, we demand that we retain this because we hate politicians and we don't trust them to do what we want them to do. So, but it, they might call that into question just a little bit when you're on page 85 of of the second book, when you're trying to just get to the poll. So, San Franciscans, we're going to get hit doubly hard and in ways that even folks otherwise in the state aren't.
Well, and let's talk about some of these that you find either most interesting, outrageous, necessary. I mean, what are some of them?
I'll just start with this because this is like a soapbox issue of mine. When it comes to public policy generation, especially the California initiative process is one of the worst ways to enact policies ever. And I will say this to anyone who comes up to me and asks me about it, because it is completely inflexible. The only way that you can amend or repeal an initiative is by another initiative. Unless the proponents say, okay, the state legislature, the city council can amend it, you know, at a certain point, which no proponent's going to do that because there's a reason why they're going through the initiative process, because they don't like the legislators or the city council members. So let's take, you know, a bad policy, a poorly written policy. It doesn't even have to be a bad policy. It could be a great idea, but it's just poorly written. You find out 5-10 years down the road, oh, wow, this is causing some problems for us. It's going to require a massive statewide election to get that thing repealed or amended. That's terrible. Who's going to fork up the $10 to $20 million that you need to get it qualified, then another $10 to $20
Munger,
to get it actually?
Munger. He'll pay.
Yes, he will. But there are very few people like Munger out there in the world. And so, the marijuana legalization being one, you know, of the whole list, you know, that's one. Gavin Newsom is really pushing it this year. On the whole, it might not be a bad policy idea, to be honest. I think it actually probably would solve a lot of issues that the state currently has. But the way that they've written the initiative is they dictate so much in that initiative. It's not like what Colorado did. It's not like what Washington State did that left a lot of the decision-making to the state legislature. It's actually written into the initiative itself. Mm. And so if we find out down the road that, oh, wait a minute, that 9.75% excise tax is a little bit too much. It's creating the black market still. Or, oh, wait a minute, there's no way for the police to actually do DUI checkpoints or anything like this. Or, oh, wow, it's actually stopping employers from hiring because there's no way for them to fire people who are using it. Or how about this? There's a medical exemption for all the taxes. Now you go to Venice Beach.
Oh, yeah.
And tell me how easy it's going to be to get yourself exempt from all the excise taxes, all the sales taxes. Oh, yeah. Sure, that's a great idea. But yet it's written into the initiative. So what's going to take for that to get amended or repealed? Another initiative. And do you think Gavin Newsom is going to fork up the money or raise the money himself to do that? No. He's going to declare victory and move on to the governor's race and saying, look, I'm a champion for progressive issues. So that's the biggest problem when it comes to the initiative process.
But it's worked well for conservatives here in California with affirmative action and immigration.
I'm not saying it hasn't worked for people. Right. It's worked very well for a lot of people, but that doesn't make it a good thing. Right. I mean, regardless of what the issue could be the best policy issue in the entire world, but it is so inflexible that it causes a lot of headaches for our politicians and for the states. You know, if you don't like what the politicians are doing, vote them out or vote new ones in. So as the electorate, and this is the unfortunate thing, the electorate doesn't spend the time they need to spend really reading these things. They read if you're lucky, they read the ballot statement, which can be confusing enough to even the people who look at these issues. And then they vote yes or no. So if ever in doubt, vote no. That's my soapbox. From the statewide issues to the city of San Francisco to whatever it might be, if you don't understand it or if there's just a little bit of doubt, vote no, because that's better.
So
trust me.
Carson hates all of the propositions. Melissa?
Actually, there are some that are really well written.
Munger's
legislative transparency one is very well written.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't it just the marijuana issue and the corruption issue on the ballot during the primaries?
No, there were only two.
I thought it was the marijuana legalization.
One state one. Well, it was the corruption.
The corruption
Prop 50.
One.
The plastic bag one qualified like a year ago.
Yeah.
In this campaign.
Are you talking about the June 7th primary?
Yeah.
That was just Prop 50, was it? Which had to do with being able to boot.
So I'm asking the question. So we've had now 17 more?
Yeah.
Since then, okay. I've been sleeping on this.
And that's because of the brilliancy of our state government, yeah, because they wanted to push Prop 30 in 2012 to the general electorate because they didn't think it was going to pass in the primary electorate.
They were afraid it was going to pass.
No, they were.
The legislature, because that was pension reform and legislature.
No, Prop 30 being.
Oh, I'm sorry, the tax.
The taxes.
I thought
increase.
That was pension reforms they did not want to have.
No, it was
June,
really Prop 30. It was really Governor Brown pushing it.
It was all political.
Yeah, it was all political. Before, whenever the proposition qualified, whether by the state vote in the legislature or by the signatures, it was on the immediately following next ballot, whether it's the June or the November ballot. That's a problem for some issues because the June electorate is very different from the November one. So the state legislature is like, no, only things that we pass can be put onto the June ballot. Everything else automatically goes to November. Now that's why we have so many things going on in November.
A couple of things that are really important, and this is, there are a couple of things that there are some interesting things like the Munger transparency one, which I'm so on board with. One of the good things, I think, even Carson has to admit, is that when you're talking about regulating the legislature, which is not going to regulate itself, the ballot can be a good way to go.
If it's written well, yes.
I'll
agree with you there.
The FPPC, like there are a number of ethics rules that we put in place using the ballot. In any event, there are three things on the ballot that sort of question our soul as a state, right? There's gun control. Mm-hmm. There's the death penalty. There's actually two death penalty measures on the ballot. One would abolish the death penalty. One would make it faster. So if your problem with the death penalty is that it's too slow, you have an option. And who knows? And then the third one is not medical, but marijuana. So, we think of ourselves as this liberal state, and yet what we poll is self-identification, right? We poll, how liberal do you think you are? Do you identify as a liberal? Do you identify as a super liberal? And so we self-identify ourselves on a spectrum, but to really test where we are on a spectrum, we're going to see it, right, after this election, depending on what happens. Does the, quicker death penalty actually went out? Does medical, do people look at medical, do people keep looking at marijuana and say, no, it's still too complicated? Remember, we rejected it in, I think, 2010 because it was just a mess of a ballot proposal. So in terms of, sort of the day after the election, I think we'll have a very good snapshot of where we actually are as opposed to where we think we are on the political spectrum out here in California.
Okay. Well, then I think it's time for a news quiz, don't you? If Fran, our news quiz prize delivery person, could come up. I think many of you have been here when we do this, but I'll just quickly explain for any newbies. I'll ask a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand. I'll call on you and shout it out then. If you're the winner, Fran will deliver unto you some Ghirardelli chocolate.
Carson is wearing flamingo socks. I feel like you should know that. I want to make sure the people in the back understand.
That
there's little flamingos all over his socks.
That's not on the quiz. Okay, first question. At least six women have alleged sexual harassment by what conservative news titan, sir? I saw your hand first. Roger Ailes from Fox News, yes.
I'm clapping because this is going on. Shocked, I tell you, I'm shocked.
Okay. Former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair expressed regret after he was harshly criticized by a report from the so-called Chilcot inquiry into what? What were they investigating? Ma'am?
The Iraq
War and his bringing the country into it. That's correct. Let's stay over on the other side of the pond. Conservative member of the UK Parliament, Andrea Leadsom, who, by the way, dropped out of the race today. I don't know if you saw this. They now have as of Wednesday, will have their second female prime minister, Theresa May. But that's not the question. Andrea Leadsom, who was running against Theresa May, she was widely criticized after suggesting what would make her a better prime minister. Saw your hand first, Gary. Because she has children, that's correct. She said that she has children, so she has a reason to be supportive of the future.
Wow.
Yeah, she was pretty roundly criticized. Hey, Goldie Mikkelsen, or it might be Mikkelsen, I'm not sure. She was the oldest person in the United States. She just passed away. How old was she? Sir? 113, that is correct. You all sound so sad, like you didn't know her, okay? Okay.
Crazy.
Regulators have banned for 2 years the chief executive of what company, it's a Bay Area company, from owning or operating a medical laboratory. Sir, I saw your hand right up. I wasn't even done.
Theranos.
Theranos, that's correct. The son of what slain mass murderer threatened revenge on the United States? Ma'am in the back in the yellow. Osama bin Laden, that is correct.
Well, see, he has a kid, so.
Family values.
He's qualified.
So, I don't know if you saw this story. Why did 8 inmates of a Texas prison temporarily break out of their jail cell? Ma'am, I saw your hand right up there. That's right. A guard had collapsed. I think he had a heart attack, and they broke out in order to get help to him. So, and Fran, how many more do we have left in there? 3? Okay. Where is the United States sending 560 more troops? Someone maybe who hasn't won already. Ma'am in the...
Afghanistan.
No. Way in back standing up. Iraq, that is correct. 560. Yes, they're not going to be able to do a lot. If anyone cares, they're there to help secure an airport that I think they had just taken back from ISIS. So, over the weekend, some annoying people, many of our friends, took over Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter feeds, decluttering them up with posts about what new Nintendo game. Someone who hasn't won yet? Pokemon Go, that is correct. And one more. So we mentioned Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She had joked that if Donald Trump is elected, she might be forced to move where? Ma'am, right on the end there? New Zealand, that is correct. We'll see if that happens. By the way, we'll be back with more News Quiz questions and, of course, a lot more to talk about on Monday, July 25th, right here in San Francisco, first day of the Democratic Convention. You know, we'll preview that, and we'll be reviewing the Republican Convention. And you can find our week-to-week News Quiz on Huffington Post every Friday. Thanks to our panel, Melissa Kane, Dr. James Taylor, and Carson Bruno. Thanks to all of you here and everyone listening and watching online. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.